Blog Talk Radio.
Is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities that are transforming our world. We talk about a world in a state of transformation, and unlike what you're likely to hear most anywhere else, we believe that the world is being transformed into a better place. We believe that the world is getting better all the time. And we believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're probably just not paying attention. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-futurist, co-blogger, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm also great.
Well, we've got some fun stuff that we've got to talk about tonight. A little bit of a mixed bag we're looking at this evening. I think kind of a little of this, a little of that, but that can make for a fun show, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's and sometimes these shows where we do things that are just not related at all to each other, we find the connections during the show. So maybe that'll work out too.
Find those astounding connections or make them. That's create those connections. That's important. And we've also got on the line our chat host, Michael Darling. Hello, Michael.
Good evening.
Now, I would like to start out this evening with a brand new feature, and I wish I had fun music for it, but I don't. I don't have a fun intro for it. It's kind of like a subset of Astounding Science Facts. It's something I'd like to call Nature Encroaches, I guess, or something like that. Now, as most everyone listening knows, I live in suburban Denver, Colorado. In fact, I live in Highlands Ranch, which is sort of the ultimate suburb. It's like the king of the suburbs. And we are in an area that used to be kind of the bottom of the metro area, and now there's actually stuff down below us. But we take pride in, we've got a lot of green belts, a lot of open space, and there are places where theoretically things connect all the way up to the mountains. And one of the interesting consequences of that is that you get a lot of wildlife coming into Highlands Ranch that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see in a suburban neighborhood. Not that much. I mean, it's not like we have mountain lions running the street, or at least we haven't lately. But I don't know if you saw this on the local news, Michael. Did you see where there was a bear walking around Highlands Ranch the other day?
I saw where there was a bear on the streets of Highlands Ranch. I did.
Now, when was the last time you guys had a bear up there in Centennial?
I don't know.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying. You guys, you used to be like the ultimate suburb, but you're a little more like settled, a little more gentrified now, right?
We just don't report stuff that's not news, so I'm not so sure we would have reported that.
Now, see, Centennial, you can tell it's much older than Highlands Ranch because the trees are taller than the houses.
Yes, there's some truth to that. Although it should be noted for anybody who's now going to go, yeah, I'm going to figure out if there's even bears in that part of the world. Centennial's only been an incorporated municipality for coming up on 8 or 9 years, although there are plenty of houses here that were built right after World War II, so 50, 60 years ago, far predating what we would have to think of as the neo-Highlands Ranch.
Sure. I mean, back in those days, they had grizzlies probably coming into the neighborhood, Sasquatch. I mean, I don't doubt. But anyway, it was big news. Bear walks into Highlands Ranch. Bear walking around Highlands Ranch. Actually, I got home from work, and I just turn on the computer and look at my Gmail account, and there's the Highlands Ranch Community Association has sent out an alert from the Douglas County Sheriff. There is a bear sighted in Highlands Ranch. So the funny thing about that is, I did not do this, but apparently a good deal of my neighbors did. Many of them did, because of course the instructions are just stay in your home, animal control's on the case, all will be well. So what do people do when they get this message that there's a bear?
Let me guess. everybody's in the street looking for this thing.
That's right. Everybody runs out. They're all looking for the bear. And sure enough, some people were fortunate enough to be the ones who were on the street where the bear was and got great, like, iPhone pictures of the bear and video of the bear.
I can tell you the first picture is the bear at a distance. The second picture is the bear closing in. The third picture is like the inside of the mouth of the bear.
that's what they're risking. Although,
yeah,
the thing that made it funny is that this bear was probably about the size of my two Shih Tzus. Okay. This was.
It was Winnie the Pooh.
Bear. Yeah, it was like Winnie the Pooh. You know, it was like, this was not Yogi, this was Boo Boo. Okay. this was not a significant bear at all. And, of course, now you think, oh, it's just a cute little cub. Now, bear cubs are probably the most dangerous of all bears. And you know why.
Well, mama's somewhere around.
Exactly, right. They're the most dangerous of all because they're cute, and you walk up to them and you think, hey, I'll play with this bear, and then mama shows up and she will rip you to shreds. So, but Mama was nowhere to be seen. Bear cub enters Highlands Ranch, leaves Highlands Ranch. There's a big media blitz, and I thought it was kind of interesting that there was a bear in my neighborhood. And the thing that drove it home to me and turned it into a segment on Fast Forward Radio was last night. Speaking of my Shih Tzus, you know, I have, the larger one is Rigel, the smaller one Barney, about whom we've spoken many times on this program. I had taken them to the groomer and gotten their summer haircuts. So these rather diminutive dogs are even smaller looking now than normal, okay? So it's last night, getting ready for bed. Barney, the dog, Rigel's already come in. Barney's out there in the backyard doing what dogs do before you put them to bed. And there's just this flutter and this swooping sound, this whoosh. And, you know, things happen very fast, but a large bird like buzzed the top of my dog and then flew away. And I'm looking at this and I'm trying to put together, what did I just see? Because it's late at night and I'm pretty sure that it was an owl.
Yeah, an owl going to try to get some dinner there, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was an owl who thought he was onto a rabbit, got close enough and then realized, oh, that's not a rabbit, it's a little too big, and flew away. So, but that was a true close encounter because, you think about, hey, coyotes might get into the yard and mess with my pets. I had never thought about an aerial attack before. And yet,
I lost a cat to a hawk. Ooh, that was about 4 years ago.
Wow, did you see it happen?
Yes, I did, from a distance. And then, you know, of course, I ran up there to try to intervene, which would have been stupid. But of course, I had no chance of getting there. And basically, I had a piece of a cat left. It was kind of bad.
Ooh, good grief.
Yeah, it was.
I'm glad I've introduced this new segment on defense.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've said too much.
We're very sorry to hear about your cat.
Yeah.
As sorry as we are to hear about your cat, we're just, you know, the relief that nothing happened to Barney is tenfold, only because, you know, not only is he a beloved pet, but think of what science would have lost had Barney, this dog with the mysterious relationship to the planet Mars, been, you know, consumed by him.
Yeah, that's right.
It would have been a great tragedy. So anyway, that was just a new thing for me. I had never seen an owl out. That's not a bird I have seen in this setting. You know, in the
Highlands Ranch. Huh?
Yeah, in the heart of the suburbs like that. Yeah. I don't know, Michael. What do you got? You got owls up there in Centennial?
We have lots of owls around here. In fact, our neighbors have at least one nesting pair that have returned to their backyard every year for the last 4 years.
Do they pick up dogs? Dogs are too big, right?
the occasional small dog or cat are lost.
Wow.
You can see evidence of rabbit kill and squirrels and other small varmints, as you'd expect. But they tend not to hunt right near their nest. They kind of go out and like range away. So if they're living in your backyard, your dogs are probably safe.
I don't
they
think
need to grow some trees.
He swooped into my yard. I think he flew
that's,
in from Centennial. That's what I think.
That's very possible. I'll tell you the one thing that we should have more of, although, you know, because the climate's right and they're here, but we don't have enough water, and that's bats. I would love it if we had some bats.
Yeah, they are just very exciting creatures, bats. Well, they eat the bugs, right? I guess is why you would like.
Well, we don't have enough standing water to produce enough mosquitoes, so they can't really feed the bats. But you know, bats and chupacabra, they kind of go together.
That's a good point. Well, this is kind of turning rapidly into a Tales of the Paranormal, so I think we're going to have to leave it. But that was just a little encounter with the natural world that I felt I would like to share. So let's move on and talk about the future and some of that stuff I promised at the beginning of the program. I'd like to start out by talking about Wolfram Alpha, which launched this week. You guys are both familiar with Wolfram Alpha, and we've had a little bit of coverage of it on the blog, thanks to Sally, who did a post on it about a week and a half ago. The official, I guess this is sort of the alpha launch. Oh, that's funny, because its name is Alpha, but it's like the beta launch. It's not really 100% yet, I don't think, but the site is up and running. And for those who aren't familiar, check it out. It's wolframalpha.com. Very hard to characterize what we're talking about here. I think before you explain what it is, you have to kind of talk a little bit about it's Stephen Wolfram. Is that right, the guy's name?
Yeah, that's right.
Who started it. And he is an interesting figure in the history of technology and in science. The guy who put together the software program Mathematica, made a good deal of money off that, then took those profits and started trying to figure out how the universe works, wrote a very detailed and highly controversial book about how the universe works called, now the title escapes me. Help me out here, either of you.
I had it.
It's a new kind of science, that's it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, a new kind of science, in which he basically sets everything up as kind of a mathematical formula. I mean, sets everything up as reduces everything to some simple basic mathematical principles, but explains quite a bit, leaves quite a bit unexplained. And as I said, it's controversial. There's a good deal of disagreement as to whether he did something really significant there or whether he was just way off base. But that was his project for quite a few years, and then we don't hear much about him for a couple, 3 years, and suddenly he comes back and he's bringing the world Wolfram Alpha. Wolfram Alpha looks like a search engine, but it's not. It is, in his words, it is the first step in an ambitious, long-term project to make all systematic knowledge immediately computable by anyone. You enter your question or calculation, and Wolfram Alpha uses its built-in algorithms and growing collection of data to compute the answer. So, basically, it's a calculator. It's a knowledge calculator. It's not just a mathematical calculator, but it's a tool that you can use to figure out the answer to a question, to be given the answer to a question that requires processing of information. So, it's distinct from Google or any of the other search engines in two really important ways. First, I don't think that it's actually pulling this information directly from the internet. I don't think it's going out to the web and grabbing these answers. I think it's
no. Well, I mean, I guess what it has done, Phil, is it goes out on the internet and it has to index in some way. Various studies and things, all kinds of data about everything, but it doesn't like go to a website and pull. It doesn't, you know, if you were to type in, for example, let me give you an example. I tried how many days until Christmas, both at Wolfram Alpha and also at Google, and it was interesting. A Wolfram Alpha calculated it 222 days, and Google returned a website that then calculated, you know, I went to the website that Google gave me, and it calculated 222 days.
Okay, so Google's just one step removed for that particular example.
Right. You know, I mean, if I wanted to know what's the latest thing that Aubrey de Grey has written, you don't go to Wolfram Alpha. You would go to Google, and you would type in his name, and you could learn that, but... if you wanted to, you know, analyze some data about longevity, you'd go to Wolfram Alpha. It's a new tool.
Yeah, I think that explains it exactly. That was kind of my second point, was that Wolfram Alpha doesn't just throw you to the web and hope that that the semantic cues you put into your search algorithm are going to be enough to coincidentally match up to a site that's going to have the information you're looking for. It's only there to give you information that you've asked for. Now, according to the site, per the process, Stephen, you were talking about of cataloging and indexing information that is out there on the web, it says, as of now, Wolfram Alpha contains 10-plus trillion pieces of data, 50,000-plus types of algorithms and models, and linguistic capabilities for 1,000-plus domains. So that's off to a pretty good start. I don't think that I have 10-plus trillion pieces of data floating in my head. Maybe I do. But that is an astounding pool of information that is just now available to us for us to do exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about. I actually had a email from our buddy Wayne Radinsky from the Boulder Future Salon, and he encouraged all of us who participate in the Boulder Future Salon to log in and give it a try. And he gave an example of a basic comparison that he set up. He said, what is the difference between Chimborazo and Everest? And Wolfram Alpha came back with a good answer. It had input interpretation. Chimborazo is a mountain. Everest is a mountain. And it gave a table, showed the elevation for one, the elevation for the other, the country one is in, the country the other is in, what year the first one was climbed, what year the second one was climbed. So it's like this nice face-to-face kind of comparison. Now, you might find that table someplace. I don't know. It didn't occur to me to try to do that, Google the same thing. But if I were looking to make a comparison like that, I would probably go to Wikipedia, look up Everest, jot down all those facts, right? Mm-hmm. Then I'd go back to Wikipedia, look up Chimborazo, and try to see if I couldn't find the exact same facts on the same site. So it's a real leap forward in terms of how we're getting to knowledge that's on the internet.
I typed in what's the difference between Denver, Colorado, and Shreveport, Louisiana?
Aha.
Because Denver is roughly where you guys live, both of you, Michael.
That's right.
And I live outside of Shreveport. And it returned, first thing it gave me was the respective populations. Now, Denver proper, 557,000 people roughly. Shreveport proper, 198,000 people. But in the metro area of Denver, there's 2.277 million people. And Shreveport, including all the surrounding area, is only 376,000 people. Then it returns a map showing, you know, Denver on the map and Shreveport on the map, and a line between the two. Distance 801 miles. Flight time 1 hour 25 minutes. Current local times. Thought that was interesting. Approximate elevations. Y'all really are Mile High City, 5,279 feet, 1 foot shy of a mile, and Shreveport, Louisiana. You want to hazard a guess what our elevation is?
I'm going to say maybe you're 15 feet above sea level.
What do you think, Michael?
I was going to say 64.
Actually, we are way up there because, you know, we're not on the coast, so, you know, we're an entire 144 feet above sea level.
My goodness.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
The nosebleed alone.
Nosebleed section, yes,
yeah.
Of Louisiana.
So any water that's running downhill from you to the coast is just screaming.
Oh, yeah. It's just, that's why we call them bayous instead of rivers. They don't scream. They just kind of meander. But you're right.
They just sort of slide by you.
So slow you can't even tell it's happening.
Wow. So that's very cool. That's a nice Just sort of level set between two places. You kind of get the real feel for some of the similarities, some of the differences. I did I couldn't make it find anything. I was sticking all kinds of stuff in there, and you saw Stephen before the show. I sent you. I did this. What's the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars? It actually did come up with an answer to that, and it showed Star Wars as the original movie from '77, and Star Trek as the new brand new movie out this year. And who directed each and who was in each. But you know, that's not any great shakes. I've been interested lately in omega-3 oils, and I've been puzzled about whether I should be eating more fish oil. Should I be eating more flaxseed? It seems like there's
or supplementing or what? Huh?
Yeah. What do I do? Do I take supplements? Do I take pills? And one of the big questions in my mind has been, well, what's the difference between fish oil and flaxseed? Because these are like the two great sources that you're told for getting this into your diet.
I happen to know the answer to that, but go ahead.
Well, so I did. I went to Wolfram Alpha and I said, compare flaxseed with fish oil for omega-3 content. And it brought back this really nice table that showed, you know, for fish oil, how many calories, how many grams of fat, what those break down to. Same thing for flaxseed. And it was, you know, you had your DHA and all your different molecules that make up the omega-3 oil. It was very useful, handy information.
Yeah.
And Sally points out in the chat room that fish oil is from fish, whereas flaxseed oil is from flax.
Oh yeah.
Technically, flaxseed oil is from flax seeds, Sal. No points there. Actually, I have flax seeds. I've been grinding them up, and it's like you sprinkle them on your food, and you get a little boost of omega-3 throughout the day. But I'm sorry, Stephen, you said you had something you wanted to say about the difference.
Well, it's just that I believe this is the difference. Flaxseed it's almost omega-3 fatty acid. Apparently, it's like a precursor that your body can quickly convert and make omega-3s out of. Whereas when you're eating fish, you're getting straight omega-3.
Right. That's right.
It goes right
into your system. Whereas with flaxseed, if you eat flaxseed oil or if you just eat ground flaxseed,
some sort of precursor.
Yeah, your body's producing it, and so you get this kind of slow burn or this slow creation of omega-3 throughout the day, rather than fish oil, where boom, it's there as soon as you take it.
Yeah.
Wow. So we've ventured into an interesting area of nutrition here, but. All in the service of talking about Wolfram Alpha. So what do you think? Is this the beginning of, I think Alvis was talking a couple weeks ago about the semantic internet. That's one of John Smart's favorite topics. And I know if you look at the metaverse roadmap and the James Cascio and folks who are interested in those kinds of things, this is one of these great leaps that we talk about taking forward, is this internet that we can talk to, that we can interact with the way people interact with each other. What do you think? Is this are we there yet? Are we 10% of the way there? 20%?
No, it's not even the beginning of the beginning. It's the precursor. Here's why. I mean, two things. One, Wolfram Alpha describes itself as being easy to use language and natural language, easy to use interface, which I would differ, because you ask a question or you do a search, something like stars in the Milky Way. I want to see an answer, if it's natural language, that says 2 to 4 billion. And that's not what you get. You get something like 2 times 10 to the 11th ranging to 4 times 10 to the 11th. I'm like, yeah, okay, so now tell me what's 10 to the 11th again? Because I don't talk like that in natural language.
Oh, okay. So here's what's interesting about that is, to a certain extent, it's processing the question in natural language, but it can't give the answer back in what you would perceive to be natural
language. It took a couple tries to do it. The first time it said, you know, and they have their little phrase, which is going to get really annoying to people going there trying to hack around to make it do something. You know, we don't understand what you're asking, or Wolfram Alpha can't understand your query, or whatever that little phrase is.
We don't know quite what to do with your...
Right, and then
question.
When I try to boil it down into a choppier sentence, you know, stars in the Milky Way or Milky Way total stars or whatever the heck I ended up writing, it grabbed Milky Way and wanted to tell me about the Milky Way bar as a food source. So I was like, okay.
Calories in the Milky Way bar.
Clearly not what I'm looking for, given that, you know,
which is also 10 to
stars.
The 11th, by the way.
Now, what kind of omega-3 content do you get in one of those Milky
Ways? It probably would tell you.
It depends on which fish the Milky Way bar was made from.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, so it's not quite natural language, and I found myself struggling to, you know, to think of questions that I knew it would be able to tackle, like United States per capita GDP. Okay, I have no problem with that.
Right.
None. It gave me an answer instantly. And I was like, well, okay, that's nice, but I had to know how to ask the question. I don't know how to ask the question for, you know, convert the recommended tire pressure on my Saab convertible into millibars. Well, it didn't know what the hell I was asking because I didn't know how to ask that question.
So there's language problems on both sides.
I disagree, though, with Michael. I think this is the beginning of something important. I think it's a humble beginning, and I agree with the problems that both Michael and you, Phil, have seen. But I think this is fundamentally different from anything we've seen before on the internet. It's calculating an answer to a natural language query, and not just sending you off someplace else based on words in your query.
Right.
And
well,
so, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I was talking to my wife about this earlier this evening, and she said, "So this is like Ask Jeeves." And I said, "It's not." And the difference is, Jeeves did attempt to do some natural language recognition and provide answers, but they were stock answers to questions. Ask.com, there was this notion of, well, we've got experts and they're going to write stock answers to questions, so if you ask a question, you'll get that answer. Or we'll send you off to a website and you're on your own just like you would be with Google or Yahoo or any of the rest of them. This is different because this is not a matter of someone has written a stock answer. There is an intelligence, however rudimentary, on the other end, that is processing the question and attempting to formulate the answer from knowledge that it has. And I agree, Stephen, that is a significant step forward. However haltingly and awkwardly we may be taking it, I think this is huge.
Yeah. It right now it's pretty basic. You know, who knows where it'll be in 5 years.
Because there's a Jeeves, you know. With Ask Jeeves, there really wasn't a Jeeves. It was a great idea, but there wasn't really a dude, you know.
I mean,
there's a picture of him, but he wasn't there.
There really is a Wolfram. and I'm not talking about Steven. I'm talking about, you know, the AI wherever that's figuring out what we're trying to say, and it's actually producing an answer on its own.
Right. So the trick is to, I think, greatly increase its capacity for understanding questions and for talking, for giving answers back in terms that we'll understand. But I bet we'll see significant strides. Even a year from now, I bet there will be a very different Wolfram Alpha experience than what we're encountering now. And I also wonder, based on that name, if maybe this isn't the last thing. Will there be a Wolfram Beta? Is it possible that the world will be taken over somewhere by Wolfram Gamma or Delta or I don't know, maybe he wants to time it so that Wolfram Omega, that sounds pretty intimidating. That's the one that pretty much knows everything, huh?
Yeah, that's post-singularity there.
Yeah.
Wolfram Omega.
Wolfram Omega. I don't know. I'm going to have to write him an email and tell him that's the direction he wants to take it. Well, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio. On the Blog Talk Radio Network, we're talking about Wolfram Alpha. We're going to talk a little bit about aging and tough choices. And coming up towards the end of the program, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening this summer with Fast Forward Radio. We're kind of taking the show, as I hinted a couple of weeks ago, in some exciting directions and looking forward to giving you a little bit better idea, not a complete idea yet, still kind of teasing you with it, of what's going to be happening there. So let's talk about this horrible unfair treatment that I gave to John Stossel on the Speculist earlier this week. I don't know, Stephen, if you had a chance to see that.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well,
I don't know that. Now, I mean, he might come off like, you know, kind of the bad guy in your post, but I don't know that was your intention. You were just trying to let words, you know, it take, you know, go to the final destination of where his arguments were taking you.
Yeah, I was just trying to kind of tease out the implications, and I felt that there were good reasons for him, as a network TV guy, not to say things as bluntly as I said it, but I don't think there was any getting around that's what it means. If you spend less on seniors, or if you do less for seniors, actually that was the way he put it, you're talking about providing less medical care. You're talking about the fact that with less medical care, some people will die. Now, I went to great pains to say, and I'll say it again, for all the good it will do, that I'm not actually taking a stand one way or another on what Medicare should be. Should it be bigger? Should it be fixed? Should it not exist? I recognize the fact that there are people across the spectrum on that issue. And my purpose in writing wasn't to take a stance on Medicare. But one of the things that I noticed in the comments was it doesn't matter how vociferously you say that, people want to argue about Medicare. So you would get these comments about, well, you're talking about, you know, intergenerational theft, and you think it's important. You know, it's like, no, I'm just saying that what he's saying is that we should let, with this system, the way it is, we should not do as much for people, and, you know, I don't know any other way to interpret it. Some people are going to die if that's what happens. I'm not saying that's wrong. I mean, it's entirely possible that people who say Medicare is going to collapse even before the more recent gloomy projections we heard earlier this week, that it's the collapse is imminent, and when that happens, nobody gets treated. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the answer is.
Well, the thing about it is this, Phil. I mean, if it's sort of the situation where we have a choice to make as a society. You know, when we're looking at longevity as we're looking at somebody that's entering the last years of their life, at least as we currently understand that, then, you know, how much do you spend to prolong that period of life for that segment of the population? You know, if you could literally pour the entire GDP of this country into that, and provide a few more, and provide a longer life for these people, and you could do that,
right?
And bankrupt the country doing it, or you could spend nothing on them, and then, you know, these people would drop dead overnight. You know, I mean, lots more of them would.
We would certainly be doing less for our seniors.
Yeah, if we did absolutely nothing, you know, then, you know, yeah. Good luck, Gramps. You know, and then they drop in the scores. You know, but so obviously the extremes we can't do. You know, we can't. You know, we're not so hard-hearted that we're gonna do nothing, and we can't throw our entire GDP at it to buy a few more days for somebody that's, you know, on their way out. But you had an important story in your family about what has happened recently.
That's right. I mean, one of the ways that you can if you're going to take this existing system and say we have to do less, one of the logical ways of doing less, I cited some statistics that talk about if you're spending an awful lot on seniors, if you're spending an awful lot on people who are going to die anyway, where the money all gets spent is in the final 6 months. So one possible solution would be to say, hey, we're going to do everything up to that last 6 months, and then, you know, we got to cut our losses. I mean, they're going to die in 6 months anyway. It's as harsh as that sounds, I can certainly see why you would make that argument. Say, well, we'd get the bulk of the savings if we didn't prolong people's lives by 6 months who are just going to die anyhow. I mean, that sounds about as logical as you can possibly get. My problem with that one is, and yeah, I used an example from my own family. My father had a pretty significant has been dealing with a pretty significant case of bone cancer over the last few years, and probably about this time last year, you know, things were looking pretty bleak. Things were not looking good at all, and if one were to make a projection at that point, it's entirely possible that somebody would have said, yes, he's hit the slide. He's on the last 6 months. Treatments would have been cut off. And, you know, I mean, one thing's for sure. Once you declare somebody's on the last 6 months and cut off treatment, you've got a self-fulfilling prophecy there.
Yeah, it is the last 6 months for sure then.
That will almost certainly become the last 6 months. Well, a year later, my dad is doing very well. I pointed out that a month ago he was able to see the birth of his new granddaughter, or not the birth, but he's got to meet his new granddaughter, and for all we know, he'll be around for her high school graduation. So setting a standard like the 6 months is not as cut and dried as we would like it to be. So my point is that this is not that I want to tell anybody what we should do with Medicare. Fund it more, fund it less, I don't know. My point is that where we are currently is too limited, that the possibilities that we're choosing from are not they're not good choices, and they put us in a position where we have to choose things that aren't really what we want to choose. So I come back to the idea that, well, let's do something about the fact that all these people are going to die. That's my take on it. Rather than talking about how expensive it is treating them for the last 6 months, let's take Aubrey de Grey at his word. Let's fund serious research into strategies for engineered negligible senescence. Let's cure the seven deadly causes of aging. And suddenly that overwhelmingly expensive Medicare bill, I think, becomes vastly reduced. Because what people die of are the things, the damage that's caused by those seven different kinds of cell damage that Aubrey traces in his book, Ending Aging. So you know, let's put some new possibilities on the board, and I think that Ending Aging is a good one. Can you think of any others, Stephen? I'll open that up to a brainstorm.
Well, I mean, that's the big one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if we can attack aging in its source, then you have older people that, you know, would have formerly been in their last decade or 6 months or whatever, that all of a sudden the future's kind of open in front of them. And you don't and that's the thing. Young people the burden of taking care of a young person, their health, someone that's in the prime of their life, it's rather minuscule. But a person that's that is frail, a person that is on their way out, basically, they're very, very expensive, and the burden is great on the system. So, you know, if we can just take that, you know, allow people to live without having that without being frail. I mean, that you talk about an extreme
state. Right, take frailty out of the equation. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous idea. This is, I think, where I got into trouble with some people, is that one of these facts that. And let me just go back to make. So I got accused of putting words in John Stossel's mouth and picking on John Stossel. And I'm sorry, that whole thing just amuses me to no end, because I think I think of John Stossel as this guy who kind of puts it out there as this sort of, I mean, obnoxious guy, right? I mean, he wants to be provocative.
Well, he was trying to be controversial.
Yeah.
He was trying to say a shocking thing, so as to I mean, if you're always boring all the time, you're not going to have any viewers. So.
Right. Yeah, so he puts it out there. I kind of like. I mean, he had that one book about shoveling the. I don't know how he phrased it, but it was great. He's funny. I like him. I don't think he wants old people to die, or that he's trying to kill people. But I think that he fell into a rhetorical trap that's very easy to fall into when your possibilities are so limited. If you look at this thing and you say, well, one way or another, Medicare is all we got, and that's what we've got to deal with, then you're stuck. You're stuck in a position where you say, well, some bad thing is going to have to happen. So he fell to a kind of a defensive place where he starts putting a little bit of blame on these seniors, putting them in a little bit of a little bit of a bad light.
Because the Lord knows they really enjoy being frail.
right. Well, it felt a little off to me.
Yeah.
But I understand how you get to that place, and I understand why he was doing what he was doing. And I think to your point, you get frailty out of the equation, how much does it cost to do that? Well, one of the things Stossel talked about was this $34 trillion bill that's going to come due potentially on Medicare for paying for everybody's treatment. Well, $34 trillion is just, I mean, even with the news we've been hearing lately, $34 trillion is just outside of the scope of anything anybody is ready to deal with, I think. It's just a bigger number than you can possibly deal with. But what I said was, look, if you're going to spend $34 trillion on Medicare anyway, just add another trillion. So you got 35, it divides nice by 7. Spend $5 trillion each on the 7 deadly causes of aging from Aubrey's analysis, and cure aging once and for all. You save 40 million lives of the people who are age 50 and up in the short term, and you save more than 300 million lives, just counting Americans, in the long term. Now, I wasn't really arguing for spending $35 trillion. It sounded like I was, but what I was really arguing for was, look, if you're going to spend money on this anyway, open up the possibilities. Do something that is truly going to make a difference. I don't think it would cost $35 trillion. I don't know what $35 trillion is. I don't think it would cost $35 trillion to cure aging. I think it would cost significantly less than that. But
well, I would hope so. I think you could put a colony on Pluto for that.
Yeah. But whatever that price tag is, doesn't it seem like it would be worth it? You know, and I don't care if the government does it or if it's a private initiative. You know, I don't want to get into that. But doesn't it seem like that would be an undertaking worthy of us as a society, one way or another, to take that on?
Well, and you know, let's put it a little bit differently. What if we could do it for $500 billion? You know, I mean, you're talking about then just a small portion of this projected $34 trillion amount. So,
exactly.
So just on the off chance that Aubrey's got it right, you know, let's give ourselves the possibility. There's the old joke about the guy praying to God to let him win the lottery, and then he doesn't, and he's all mad at God, and God, you know, the voice from above says, "Well, meet me halfway, buy a ticket."
Yeah, you got to buy a ticket.
That's the deal. Let's buy the ticket. Let's fund sins and see what happens. What's the worst that can happen? We're another $500 billion. You know, in the whole, I mean, that's nothing when you're looking at the grand scope.
Absolutely. Well, Matt points out in the chat room that $35 trillion is approximately humanity's military spending for 35 years.
Yep.
So that's an interesting way of looking at it. But forget $35 trillion for a minute. There might be other approaches. There might be other ways that would get us there. We talk about nanotechnology. We talk about a lot of these different technologies that might. That might make a tremendous difference. One piece that only occurred to me today was I saw an article on Future Pundit that Glenn Reynolds had linked to. Randall Parker writes this very interesting piece, "Virtual Medical Visits Work as Well as Real Ones?" That's the question. And it turns out that in certain instances, they absolutely do. Circumstances have to be right, but you can get as good a medical care, as good a consultation with a doctor via a virtual visit as you can via a, you know, what do you call it, scalpel and mortar visit to the actual doctor. Well, to me, that doesn't, obviously that doesn't solve any problems right away, but what happens when down the road, and here's where we start tying things together, Stephen, you've got a Wolfram Alpha type doctor out there.
No, why have him out there? If we're talking Wolfram Alpha, why not have a Wolfram Alpha robot unit within your home?
There you go. You know, what happens when...
Standing next to your bed, checking your vitals, you know?
What happens when consultation with the medical authority, doesn't necessarily have to be a human doctor, but a competent medical authority who can check what's wrong with you and get you on the right track treatment-wise, what happens when that becomes essentially as inexpensive as a Google search is today?
Yeah.
You know, if that
works, you're not talking 30. You're not talking $34 trillion anymore, are you?
I don't think so. I think that that even without curing aging, even without the singularity, even without some of the big things happening, just tracking some of the trends that we're seeing you know, just watching today, just talking about things we're talking about today, that we could be in a very different situation in fairly short order. And it's because there are possibilities, there are technologies that are opening up new and different and better ways of doing these things. So I'm very optimistic that that we're going to see a society actually doing more for its seniors, or enabling seniors to do more for themselves by way of actually having their care taken care of for them, having it be something that they're proactively involved in and something that they have abundant access to. So, and that can occur even without the cure to, for aging. And when you start looking at these different possible approaches, nanotechnology, the cure for aging, artificial intelligence, and you start thinking, well, back to your, what was it, $500 billion?
Yeah.
You know, invest $500 billion in 10 of these things, and even $5 trillion is a drop in the bucket compared to $34 trillion, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if a couple of these, if a couple of these come, you know, drive it home, you've got not just the benefit for this current set of this current generation of seniors that we're concerned about right now, but the benefits are ongoing from here on in.
Well, we keep talking, you know, as if there's just one sole entity that will just make these decisions. The government, you know, is about as close as to being that entity as there is, but we still have a private sector that's going to throw money at what it feels like will, you know, turn a profit. And what would be more profitable than curing aging or, you know, are providing seniors with a robot that could take care of them in their waning years. I mean, that these things would be profitable. It's just a matter of baby steps to get there, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, I think that curing aging is a tremendously potentially tremendously profitable technology for whoever comes up with it, because you've got the baby boomers sliding into their golden years here.
Yeah.
And they are not going gently into that good night. And you give them some options, and they're going to take those options as it is.
Yeah, got one word for you: Viagra.
There you go. Yeah.
Major blockbuster drug. You come up with other pills and injections and various treatments that give people back valuable parts of their lives. They will pay for it. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that there's tremendous potential for the private sector, and if the government is going to be involved, then one of the ways they might be involved actually is to encourage some of the kinds of development that might go in the private sector, and just allow some of that to happen, maybe lift some restrictions in some instances, and it's possible there's funding, but you know, I'm not arguing for any of that. All I'm saying is that. Is that between the government and the private sector, between nanotech and curing aging and artificial intelligence and a lot of these different technologies that we talk about, there are tremendous possibilities. There are tremendous potentialities to do good here, to really make a difference in what aging means, what end of life means, what all of this stuff means. And to affect a permanent change, not just to save tax money in the U.S. in the year 2009, which of course is a very important thing. That's no mean feat, but this is a turning point for humanity, one of many that we talk about on this program, but nothing less than a turning point for humanity. And I think we're going to turn the corner. That's my optimistic take.
Well, you know, you ever notice how picking on this guy again. What was his name that you were picking on?
John Stossel.
Have you ever noticed how most gloom and doom arguments are what they would call in economics ceteris paribus arguments? They always assume that the world is going to stay the same, except that we're going to continue on this path forever until, you know, the bitter end.
Right.
It's never like that. The world's always changing in so many different ways that we can't even keep up with it. And so you can't extrapolate, you know. I mean, yeah, things, you know, our medical costs are going up and up and up per person, and here we can see where our population is going. More and more people are going to be old. Well, I mean, but that does not mean that in 20 years we're going to be bankrupt. Different things will come up. Different things happen. I always have.
Yeah.
So
there are a lot of balls in play, and if you look at just one, you're really going to miss the actual picture. You're going to miss what's really likely to happen and what's going to happen. So yeah, I think the possibilities are there, the potentialities are there, and I'm bullish that we're going to capitalize on those. I'll let Michael and or the chat room have the last word on this. Any questions, comments, thoughts on my mean treatment of John Stossel?
We think you should publicly apologize to John Stossel in the most degrading way you can think.
Well, I will get right to work on that.
Start groveling.
Actually, the the chat has tended more towards, like, you're going to get nanotechnology. You have an advancing medical technology. Sally makes a point that, especially in the blogosphere and in what I would extend to mainstream media, discussions about medical treatment and medical technology never assume that anything is going to be any better than it is now. The ceteris paribus assumption that Stephen's talking about is exactly where the discussion starts and ends.
Yep.
Right.
And it makes no sense. I mean, if John Stossel had been reporting in 1900, oh my God, life expectancy was 41. No, it's 80 something. Oh yeah, we doubled in a century. How do we do that? Well, it was soap and antibiotics, but now we got stuff like Tamiflu and knee replacement surgery and so on and so forth, and it's a whole different animal. This is an area where I think it's hard to predict what it'll look like. Although I would say that Phil, your math is you reversed a positive or a negative sign somewhere, because you said, hey, if we fund research on SENS and then we get, you know, we cure the seven deadly causes of aging. Yeah, but that increases the Medicare budget. It probably, like, doesn't even double it. It takes it out to infinity. It gets you an asymptotic graph. And I just looked up on Wolfram Afra, and it says the same thing.
Okay. Well, you know, my understanding was there'd be no math on tonight's show, but I just want to point out that I majored in English, so I get myself into trouble with some of that stuff sometimes. Okay, well, yeah, I think we've treated this one as best we can. The point being, John Stossel, I do apologize if you're listening, just on the off chance. But open your eyes, you and all your viewers and everyone listening and everyone concerned about these issues. Open your mind and your eyes to what's possible. Open your mind, open your eyes and your mind to what we can do, what is within our capability, because it far exceeds the limits that we assume by thinking that the world is not going to change. The world is changing now, and it is going to change. And speaking of which, I'd like to move us now into our final topic of the evening, unless you had anything else you wanted
to
say on that topic. I want to talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing with Fast Forward Radio this summer. We've talked a little bit about having kind of a special series. And I believe what we're going to do is we're going to kick this off probably in the second week of June. It'll probably be the week of June 14th or possibly June 21st. But we'll make an official announcement around this with all the details at the Speculist here in the next week or so. But this is going to be the Summer of Transformation, and we're going to do a 10-part series on Fast Forward Radio, a 10-part series on the topic of the world transformed. And we're going to talk about, in some ways, material that is nothing new, because we're going to be talking about things that we talk about here every week and that we've talked about on every Fast Forward Radio since we started Load These many years ago. But with a slight difference in that we want to kind of put it all together. We want to map out what are the levers. What are the major transformations that we are in the midst of or on the verge of that are going to completely reshape our world or reshape us, reshape who and what we are as human beings? We've got a great pool of resources of folks to talk to, thanks to the the many fine guests we've had on the program over the last couple of years in particular, but actually since we started doing the show. And what I'm hoping that we'll do is we will bring some of these folks back. We'll probably line up some new guests, people that we've never had on before, and we're going to work our way through these ideas. We're going to talk about the singularity. We're going to talk about nanotechnology. We're going to talk about life extension, and all of it with an eye to how is the world being transformed? What is the transformation that's going to take place? So our program on life extension, I've already got a working title for that one, and that is Mortality Transformed, the Coming Era of Indefinite Lifespan. When we talk about human augmentation, expanding the human being with implants, with via drugs, I envision us doing a program called Humanity Transformed, I should say, reworking the human architecture. We'll talk about society transformed with the era of the empowered individual. We'll talk about human destiny transformed with the singularity. So each of these programs, 10 programs, will focus on some pivotal area of our lives, some pivotal area that we've been talking about on this program anyway, and talk about this major transformation with a guest for most of these programs sharing with us some of the kind of cutting-edge thinking around each of these areas. So that's what we've got to look forward to this summer. I think it's going to be very exciting. It's going to be a lot of fun. We might be moving Fast Forward Radio from Sunday evening to a weeknight. We're looking at what's possible there and what's going to be a good idea there. But all of that will be included in the announcement, and certainly would welcome feedback from anyone listening live. If you want to leave a comment in the chat on that, drop us a line at blog.speculus.com if you're listening on the via iTunes or via MP3. So that's kind of the plan in a nutshell. Stephen, did I cover it adequately? What else should I say about this?
It's going to be big. We've never attempted anything quite this big before. We've done 2- and 3-part segments before, but this is going to be huge. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to do, and I look forward to it. And I know all of us do.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. You know, the closest we ever came to this was at Convergence 08 when we did those one right after another back-to-back quickie interviews with some of these folks. Think about that kind of experience only stretched out over an entire summer with planning and with the ability to kind of think through how we're going to deal with each of these issues. Should be a real blast.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I think that does it for the program. Michael, anything from the chat room on our big, ambitious plan for the summer or any other topic?
Phil said quickie.
Oh, jeez.
Hey, Beavis and Butthead show up in the chat room once in a while. I can't help it.
What are you going to do? Okay. Well, thanks for that enlightening comment, Michael. And Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
Well, we got some neat music tonight. It's John Schmidt. He's got a little 4-year-old daughter who loves the song from Taylor Swift, Love Story. And she talked with her dad about how she, you know, there's this part in the song where the boyfriend's being chased off by the mean dad, and then of course the boyfriend comes and it looks like it's all over, but then he comes back, talks with the mean dad, and they square away their differences, and it's a love story. Go pick out your wedding dress and all.
White dress. Oh yeah, we've all heard the song.
Yeah, it's a great song. But anyway, so this musician, he arranged a version of this song. It's instrumental, and then it plays into Coldplay's "Viva La Vida," and I saw it on YouTube, and the absolute joy that this musician had doing this. You just got to see the video after you hear the music here in just a second, but it's obvious that it was a labor of love, perhaps, you know, for his daughter, but also he just obviously loves music, and it's interesting how these two pieces of popular music work so well together.
Okay, so this is a song about a song that incorporates that song and yet another song. Is that
It's Love Story as an instrumental, and then followed up by Viva La Vida, and then actually I've left the interview where he kind of talks a little bit about the song after it. So, you know, if you care to hear, you can listen to him talking about how his inspiration for the song afterwards. So.
Wow, that is working on a lot of levels. So. Enjoy the music and you know, contemplate the universe while you're enjoying it. Thanks for that, Stephen. Thanks for your contribution to the show this evening, and to you, Michael, to our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and to all of you listening here.
Sorry, Bill, I started it early. I'm going to stop it and let you finish your.
Oh, just going to say, look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it. And now, cue music.
Okay.
Yeah, this arrangement is dedicated to my little daughter, Sarah. My 7-year-old, cute little Sarah. She loves this song by Taylor Swift. And one time we were listening to it in the car, and she says, "Dad, this is my favorite part. It's right where the key change happens, and it looks like the boyfriend has gotten scared off by the mean dad, and never coming back. And she's about to lose hope, and all of a sudden he comes back and he says, "Hey, I talked to your dad," and he pops the question, and, "Go pick out a white dress." And, anyway. That's Sarah's favorite part, and I tried to, when I got to that part when I was arranging it, I tried to extend that moment out a little bit. Just felt like it should go to Viva La Vida by Coldplay. So it's Love Story meets Viva La Vida.